From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, and welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Today's story is a tragic continuing saga. And spoiler alert, it is a story that does not, at this point, have an ending. However, we feel it is important for more people to be aware of this conspiracy, this cover-up, this semi-apocalyptic series of very unfortunate events. This story comes to us, folks, courtesy of one of your fellow listeners who left us a message. Oh, God, Matt, was it 2019?
Oh, no, Ben, this actually came from 2020 this year, and we just want to say thank you, anonymous teacher. We would be playing your voicemail right now, but you asked us not to.
Well, we did, of course, play it for ourselves as a group, but as we always say, you know, we want to respect people's wishes for privacy.
We didn't think you sounded scatterbrained at all, for the record.
An anonymous teacher, you raised a very interesting point. You also did something that I love to hear, which is you mentioned some of your own research in this matter, in the story of the Marshall Islands. Now, a lot of people have probably heard of the Bikini Atoll, especially if you're interested in the history of nuclear testing, nuclear revolution. But there's a larger, much larger story at play here. And to explore this story, we have to first explore the Marshall Islands themselves, which are going to be unfamiliar with a lot of people in the U.S., especially if you don't have any relatives in the military or you haven't yourself been a part of the military. So here are the facts. The Marshall Islands are remote. Oh, man. You thought driving for a long weekend at a cabin in the mountains was a hassle? Just look at all the stuff you have to do to get from where you are now, wherever you're listening to this, all the way out to the Marshall Islands. They are about halfway between Hawaii and Australia, like right near the equator. And although it's one sovereign country now, as of 1979, it's really two kind of parallel chains, a lot of very small plots of land. It is considered what's called an associated state of the U.S. That means that since its constitution and independence in 1979, it's a sovereign country, but it has a formal, very distinct, unique relationship with the United States, and we're going to find out exactly why in this episode. I don't know why I'm laughing. This is a terrible thing. And even though it's a pretty big area of ocean and island, population-wise, it's a very small place.
That's right. An estimated 58,413 human souls live in this region, spread out across 29 coral atolls. And they're called that because they're almost like mini islands. Like, I mean, when you look at them on an aerial view, they really just look like tiny little specks. And these atolls are composed of 1,156 individual islands or islets. Most live in the capital called Majuro. And it's beautiful. You know, we're talking about crystal blue waters, you know, island paradise type getaways. It's incredibly remote, very low crime rate, and for many, many years, thousands of years, was the kind of place where you could kind of go and live a life off the grid, like Robinson Crusoe style. Unfortunately, due to a series of unfortunate events, Lemony Snicket style, this is no longer the case.
Right. Yeah, this place has a long history of human occupation dating back to at least the second millennium BCE. And as the world and the countries in the world became increasingly connected in the modern era, more and more governments, either half a world away or, you know, closer to that Pacific region, they became interested, intensely interested in controlling the territory we know as the Republic of the Marshall Islands today. As far back as 1914, Japan was interested. They were building bases, military bases on the islands. And then if you fast forward through the bloody events of World War II in the Pacific theater there, you'll see that after the United States defeated Japanese troops in the area, they turned two atolls of the Marshall Islands into military bases themselves. So it's kind of like there are two things fighting, but neither of them have the concerns of the native people at the front of their mind.
No, it's a strategic place to be. If you've got naval forces, it's a strategic place to be. And it's also strategic if you need to be isolated for some reason away from larger populations.
Ding, ding, ding. Yeah. And consider just the resupply value it offers, too. So in 1947, the islands, due to action by the UN, the islands become part of something called the Trust Territory of the Pacific Islands. They're still not a country. This was like the UN's idea officially. But this trust territory is administered, cough, cough, controlled, cough, cough, by the United States. This is Uncle Sam's new island paradise, if you will. These kind of territory grabs, we should note, super common in any post-war era. Go back to the first battles humans fought, there was usually a territory grab afterwards, and it was often about territory, no matter what kind of ideology they put over it. This happens for a number of reasons. One, as you pointed out, Matt, to gain control of a strategic point, either for shipping purposes, economic purposes, you could say, or to plan for future wars. Future areas that we could wage a good offense up from, or areas that we could easily defend. And then, of course, the big badger in the bag of every war ever, claims to local resources. Every war you have seen fought or read about is about getting stuff from other people, no matter how it's phrased. This makes the Marshall Islands Trust Territory very strange in human history, because the U.S. did have a plan for this region, but they didn't want to take anything. Instead, they wanted to leave something terrible behind. Here's where it gets crazy.
Yeah, what they wanted to leave behind was indeed something terrible, and it is a byproduct of nuclear testing. As described by Tony DeBroom, the former Minister of Foreign Affairs and Health, in 1946, the U.S. Navy pulled into the lagoon of the Bikini Atoll and told the 167 people that were living there at the time that they were going to use this land as a testing site for nuclear weaponry. They were direct in how they approached these individuals, but at the same time, it was like a shtick almost, like they'd done it before. The group phrased their conversation in such a way, almost like you would with something like eminent domain, where it's like, let us buy you out, let us, you know, help you help us, etc. They phrased it in terms of, quote, seeking permission. But they couched the mission as something that was the will of God himself, and would ultimately benefit all mankind. You can't argue with God and the benefit of all mankind, I would say. It was a sacrifice they were asking these people to make for the future safety of the entire world. And so these a small number of people, admittedly, took off. They evacuated.
They did. And now remember here, we're talking about a series of islands that make up this thing that we call the Marshall Islands or the Republic of the Marshall Islands. And they went to one one little atoll and kicked people off to do nuclear testing, which, as we all know, has a bit of an area of effect.
It's for the greater good, though.
Yeah.
The greater good. Well, as an end result of this pretty disingenuous approach, we learn that between 1946 all the way up to 1958, the United States ended up conducting no less than 67 documented nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands. It's just the nuclear test. The U.S. conducted about 23 of these tests at Bikini Atoll and then 44 near another atoll, Eniwetok. But the fallout, to your point about the area of effect, the fallout spread everywhere. It spread throughout the Marshall Islands. And when we say test, we're not talking about the nuclear equivalent of popping an M80 or a flashbang. The overall yield of these tests, due to one curve-busting monstrous bomb, the overall yield of these nuclear tests has been estimated to be to work out to an average of 1.7 Hiroshima-level detonations every day for 12 years. So this is serious. This is unending Hiroshima if you look at the way this is this can be averaged across the span of testing. And now, with the benefit of retrospect, we know much more about the test than people did during the time. Even the people living there, by the way, who in some cases were not evacuated when the testing began. So we're going to pause for a word from our sponsors, and then we'll return. We're going to dive deep into the timeline and the specifics of these tests and why they matter today.
Okay, and we're back. We are still in the Republic of the Marshall Islands, at least in the present day. That's what it's known as. And we're going to talk about something called Operation Crossroads. And that's what we've been discussing here, the nuclear tests at the Bikini Atoll and the Eniwetok Atoll. So why would you do nuclear testing there? We know that the United States had, like, around that time in the 40s, had been testing nuclear weapons on American soil out there near Nevada in the testing grounds there and perhaps in a couple other places. But, you know, why would you go out to a remote island to do this testing? Well, one of the main reasons was because the military machine wanted to know what happens to a naval vessel when a nuclear explosion occurs. How far away does it have to be to have any kind of effect? What are the effects in general? And all these other questions that I'm sure some general had in their mind, or some admiral who wanted to know what was going to happen in the future when a nuke went off near his vessel.
And I would imagine at a base level, secrecy was very important here too, right?
Sure, yeah. You don't want the American public and to a degree the Marshallese public to be able to raise a hand and say, hey, this is crazy. We live in this area. There are a couple other advantages. There were nearby military bases. This area is also, you know, this is pre-satellite surveillance nets. So this area is also more difficult for enemy forces to observe, right? Everybody's going to sense or figure out a nuclear detonation of this size. It's kind of a disturbance in the force vibe at this level of energy. But they also were doing a NIMBY thing. Everybody knows that abbreviation, not in my backyard. The Trinity test did take place in the heartland of America, or the North American continent. But now that we have discovered the process to make a nuclear bomb, we want to build better ones. We have to realize that post-1945, people are, and post-World War II, really, the U.S. public is going to start asking increasingly difficult questions about why we're blowing up stuff in our own country. So not just the generals, but the policy wonks and Congress wanted to get in front of this thing. And that's when they said, you know, we've got this place. we can go nuts here. This is the nuclear testing equivalent of Vegas, baby. Roll the dice, drop the bombs. And that's exactly what they did.
Ben, I asked you off mic, you know, if we talked about this place being like an island paradise, et cetera, with such a low population. And my question was, are these transplants from other South Pacific nations, or are they, would you consider these indigenous people? And I think the answer is a bit of both, but largely it is, they are indigenous people, correct?
Yeah. So they're, Marshallese culture is part of the wider culture of Micronesia. And if you look at the history of Marshallese culture, I don't know, we're kind of, this is a little off topic, but I'm going somewhere with this. We all have friends in New York. And if you're not from New York, or even if you are from the Big Apple, you're well aware that New York has this weird thing about when one can be called a local, right? And not just a tourist. What's the threshold? Is it like 8 years or something?
Oh, gosh. I don't know the actual official number, but it's certainly more than a couple. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's, it seems like that's a microcosmic equivalent of the larger question, which is, when do people become considered indigenous people, right? We know that with most continents and land masses in the world, there was a migration at some point in ancient history. So as far as the question of indigenous, you know, the people who live in the Marshall Islands have a very close relationship with the land and the sea. It forms part of the community and part of the culture. And it looks like they were part of, I said the second millennium BC, it looks like they were part of that larger wave of human migration 3,000 years ago that spread across the Western Pacific Ocean. So I would say, I'm not doing New York rules here, far be it, but I feel like if you've lived in an area for that long, you can be considered native, right?
Oh, totally. We're talking generations. And I didn't know this going in, but, you know, when we say that we refer to them as the Marshallese people, they also have the Marshallese language.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And so what we're establishing here is that the Marshall Islands were by no means some kind of empty room or some kind of barren, uninhabited place where these tests could occur without consequence. The first testing in the Marshall Islands occurred during something called Operation Crossroads. And that's what Matt was just talking about, folks. The idea that we need to investigate the effects of nuclear weapons on naval warships. Because, of course, the U.S. is not, well, it's many things, but it's not foolish. It's not naive enough to think that nuclear weapons will stay a U.S. joint for a long time. Other people want the new toy, right? And when they get the new toy, they're going to use it to break the toys of their rivals, like battleships, carriers, etc. So we have to find out what happens before we see it in the field. So,
well, and some of the stuff surrounding the early Operation Crossroads, the actual testing that they did, there's some weird stuff, and it's hard to imagine this was a spectacle. You know, you think of nuclear testing, at least in the beginning there, it was a very secretive thing. We talked about that. You can't let anyone know that we're testing this weapon. You don't want your rivals to know. But as we got into really the thick of Operation Crossroads, the U.S. has already dropped a nuclear weapon, two nuclear weapons, on another country. And at this point, it's almost as if the U.S. wants to publicly show the might again, but, you know, not hurt anybody, just to show that might off. So it's in this one of the testing, I believe it's called Able Shot or I think it's called Shot Able. Shot Able. They invited a ton of people out to watch this thing. They invited the press to come out. Hey, film this thing. Take pictures. Hey, check this out. Let's talk about this. Let's get it in the news so that, in my opinion, so our allies and our enemies will notice.
Similar to a military demonstration. Well, I mean, mm-hmm. It is basically a military demonstration.
Yep.
With a lab coat on.
And a big bang.
And a big, big bang. So Shot Abel occurs on July 1st, 1946. This allowed various U.S. authorities to confirm the power of these weapons, and they determined some scary stuff. They said, wow, if there were any soldiers on any ships up to a mile away from this explosion, they would be killed instantly. No takebacks, no worries about the lingering effects of radiation. It's just flipping off like a very violent light switch. And then they followed up with the Schott-Baker test later that month on July 25th. These tests were the first time the U.S. had tested nuclear weapons since the days of Trinity in 1945. And they were also the first nuclear detonations since, you know, those days in August 1945 when Little Boy and Fat Man were dropped over Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And when Operations Crossroads ended, it was on August 10th, 1946. And get this, they ended it because of very valid, pressing, terrifying concerns over radiation and the effects radiation can have on the human body. But they were worried about the human bodies of soldiers. Yeah. There weren't a lot of people on Uncle Sam's side saying, ah, yeah, what about the people who live here for longer than a tour of duty?
They also didn't worry about all the live animals that they loaded onto the ships when they detonated the nukes either to right. see what would happen.
Well, like Noah's Ark style? Like, why were they? Oh, was this to see the effects of the radiation on the animals?
The blast and the radiation. I mean, how do you think they figured out that the soldiers would be killed instantly?
Mm-hmm. Pigs, goats, and mice, I think, specifically.
Okay, so the opposite of Noah's Ark style, basically.
Yeah.
Load them onto a boat and kill them all at sea.
Mm-hmm. Well, see what will happen.
Yeah.
That's the phrase. Let's see what'll happen, which is, you know, it's a lot like if you went to court for murder because you shot someone point blank and you said, Your Honor, I wasn't trying to hurt anybody. I wanted to see what would happen for science, dude.
Yikes.
I know. So this is a huge deal, though, and a lot of people in the U.S. may be aware of the testing, but there's not much attention being paid to the people who are living in the Marshall Islands. And they kept going. They kept going because this was a perfect storm of opportunity, right? There's a post-World War lull. There's a huge boom in industry and technology in the U.S. because it's one of the few Western places that was able to preserve its infrastructure. You know, large parts of Europe were destroyed, like not decades and decades of productivity were gone in an instant. So they also didn't have a lot of people who could stop them. That was key.
We've heard that they evacuated, or that these people, I guess, willingly evacuated, like 167 something people. And we're talking about a collection of islands, you know, in the thousand, or not in the thousands, but over a thousand. So how far would this site have been from like whatever the metro center, I believe Majora, how far would this have been geographically from there?
So the distance from Bikini to Majuro is 827 kilometers.
Okay.
As the crow flies, that works out to 514 miles.
Got it.
And this is still, by the way, that might sound like it's a long way away, but we have to remember these are nuclear weapons and there are multiple tests. So there is an aggregate cumulative effect here. After Operations Crossroads ends, due to those concerns about radiation for the soldiers only, well, let's fast forward. There's still tests going on. 1950. Then President Truman decides that we're going to increase research into thermonuclear weapons because of our new frenemy, the USSR. And that the Cold War conflict was already kind of brewing toward the end of World War II, of course. So to do this, to increase this amount of research, we necessarily increase the amount of nuclear testing. And it turns out we have one place where we love to test all these world-ending toys. It's still the Marshall Islands. So something called Operation Greenhouse begins in 1950. 51. And then it goes to Operation Ivy in November of 1952. I don't know whether the band is named after that, folks, but I had the same question.
Yep, was thinking the same thing. I bet you they named it after the operation, I would guess, but who knows?
Who knows? But you know, some of their songs still hold up. So Shot Mike, you know, we had those other things we mentioned earlier, Shot Abel, for instance. There's another one called Shot Mike. It is the world's first known successful test of a hydrogen bomb. And then just a little bit later, on November 16th, Uncle Sam conducted what it called the King Shot, which sounds like a really heavy tourist drink you would get in a New Orleans bar or something.
It also sounds like vaguely Hamiltonian. I don't know why. Just because of the king and not gonna throw away my shot, you know, and all that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Man. And I don't mean to pull away from that stuff. I just want to remind everybody the difference between an atomic weapon like the ones that were dropped on Japan versus what we're just now introducing here, a hydrogen bomb. Really, the best way to think about it is the scale of destruction and the radius at which instant lethality occurs. So if you can imagine that when a nuclear weapon was dropped on Japan around, I think it was a radius of about a mile, people were killed fairly instantly when it was dropped. With a hydrogen bomb, you could increase that by about 5 times or 10 times. So like 5 miles, maybe 10 miles in a radius where people would just be instantly killed. Just so everyone's aware, especially when we're talking about proximity to the other people who lived on the Marshall Islands.
Which is huge. Yeah, it's a very good point. It's a very important distinction too. So we're going to pause for a brief word from our sponsors, and then we'll return with the story of the largest test, the one that is the reason we're looking at an average of 1.5 Hiroshimas every day for 12 years.
And the inevitable fallout.
And the inevitable fallout. We've returned, not to 2021, but to March 1st, 1954, the debut of something called Codename Bravo, which is objectively a really cool name for a terrible thing. I think it's a cool name. So the U.S. conducted the largest nuclear detonation that country has ever conducted, even now in the modern day, largest ever, full stop, on Uncle Sam's part. It was called Castle Bravo. This took place at the Bikini Atoll on March 1st. And Bravo was a 15 megaton hydrogen bomb. That is alone the equivalent of Hiroshima 1,000 times. This was only one of a series of thermonuclear tests, but it's it's the big one, and it wasn't supposed to be. This we talked about, remember, earlier in Open Skies, we talked about how many close calls the human species has had, especially with nuclear weapons. And we were talking specifically about breakdowns in communication or interpretation of what other countries are saying or signaling. In this case, we screwed it up entirely on our own. This was the first device of its kind. We had the calculations. We thought our math was solid, but we were so very wrong. And we, meaning the scientists conducting this test, got the math so screwed up that when the bomb was detonated, its nuclear yield was more than double what they had planned for or expected as consequences.
Woof. That's all I got to say about that. How do you miscalculate that much?
It's a new technology, and you know they're testing, right? That's what this thing is for. And they just didn't realize what it was going to do, how big it was going to be. And like you said, there were consequences, Ben. The fallout did drift over into two inhabited areas there in the islands. And around 200 men and women and children were living in the places where that fallout kind of just spread right on top of. And, you know, it's one of those things. We've kind of been setting up this the whole episode, right, of the dangers here for the inhabitants of these islands, and it happened.
One atoll, Rongelap, the people there found themselves instantly heavily affected by the fallout, and their, of course, their ecosystem is affected too.
And just to clarify, these are initial physical effects, not like long-term stuff like we hear about with other, you know, like the big picture of radiation. Mm-hmm. These are direct burns, you know, on people's bodies, and very quick onset of radiation diseases.
Yeah, exactly. So when you're talking about widespread heavy contamination like this, you think of it in terms of either two clocks. Or maybe it's better to think of it in terms of the hour hand and the minute hand. So the stuff that happens first, those consequences, the burns, the sickness, the radiation poisoning, that's the minute hand. And it's going tick, 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 and you're seeing the results. But the bill really comes due with what we would call the hour hand, which is the long tail effects of these things, which are very serious and can take decades to manifest. And that's a problem for the victims in these situations, because then it makes it a little more difficult to prove that someone is suffering from a medical condition because of something that happened 20 years ago. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly.
A lot of room for unethical defense lawyers to play ball on that field. So add to this, the military, the U.S. military, did evacuate these residents as well. About 2 days after the test is when they got around to it. And the people of the Marshall Islands, the Marshallese, were not informed of the potential dangers. It was all very much, you know, glory to the greater good. We're making the world a better place. You're sacrificing. But they were under the impression that the sacrifice they were making was moving for a little while. It was a very different sacrifice involved. A senator of the Marshall Islands named Jetan Anjane explained the effects of Castle Bravo in a powerful and disturbing way. He says, 5 hours after the detonation of this device, it began to rain radioactive fallout at Rongelap. The atoll was covered with a fine white powder-like substance. And listen to this part. No one knew it was radioactive fallout. The children played in the snow. They ate it.
How would you know?
How would you know?
Yeah. Oh, that is rough, man.
Yeah. It just gets rougher. In 1957, the people of Rongelap came back, but officials and scientists that were working for the AEC decided that radiation was still at play. And still very much a problem.
Well, yeah, as we said, I mean, that's not enough time. 3 years, as we said, this, and we're going to talk about later, this stuff comes in 20 years later as cancer and birth defects and all of the terrible things. Yeah. So there's this, there's a later report that comes out in 2004, and it found between the years of 1946 and 1958, the full amount of contamination that would have been generated there was in an excess of 530 cancers.
Yeah. So what that means is in that estimate, in that analysis, they said, okay, what are the average incidence of cancer in the population if all things are the same and this test never happened? Can we tell whether this radiation increased cancer? And the answer is yes, 530 times. People are more and more likely to get cancer that we can trace back in 2004. And again, it's a little difficult as time passes. So that number is probably, it's probably lower. That estimate is probably lower than the actual number, I mean to say. And 2005, the National Cancer Institute said the risk of contracting cancer for people exposed to this fallout, like your chance of getting cancer after this, 1 out of 3. That means that if the three of us on Stuff They Want You to Know Today were in the Marshall Islands at that time, one of us would get cancer. And those are terrible, terrible odds. Two or three decades after the testing ended, this is where the hour hand begins to tick. Multiple, like many, many adult citizens of the Marshall Islands developed cancerous thyroid nodules. And associated health risk increased as well. I mean, your community is shattered. You have to leave the home where, you know, generations before you lived. And that gives you stress. People have PTSD. That also coupled with some other social factors, like the importation of Western diet with the military, leads to diabetes, obesity, things that do not help you if you are contracting cancer and living in an irradiated area. It's rough because later the National Cancer Institute comes back in 2010 and they say, and we looked at all the cancer between 1948 and 1970, the Marshall Islands, and we, the Cancer Institute reports, found 1.6 of all cancers, at least during this time period in the Marshall Islands, are directly attributable to radiation from nuclear testing. What this means is that the U.S., and I won't say on purpose, but the U.S. through negligence gave these innocent people cancer. There's no way around it. They would not have had cancer if there had not been nuclear weapons exploding so often for so long.
So we're saying 1.6% of all cancers that were developed on all of the islands. That's what we're saying?
Yes. Okay.
Gotcha.
Because some places got hit much harder, right? The northern atolls, in the same study found that in the northern atolls, 55% of all cancers are the result of this fallout, more than half.
Dang.
And that one was specifically just for the Castle Bravo test alone.
The giant one.
Right, right.
Wow.
And then, you know, moving on into the 70s, the U.S. does, you know, agree that some mistakes were made. I don't know, maybe the implicate, they didn't directly say it, but they did agree to clean up the mess as much as possible, to clean up the islands. They took the crater from a previous bomb test on Runnet Island, and this was the Defense Nuclear Agency, by the way, and they built a dome to store nuclear waste. And this is, you know, we see this in other sites around the United States. For example, the Savannah River site in near Augusta, Georgia, where I grew up, is a legacy containment site for spent nuclear weapons. And they would store a lot of this material in pits that they would dig and line and bury this stuff. And they realized over time that some of those liners leaked and leached all of that stuff into the soil. They had a similar response here. The Defense Nuclear Agency built this dome to store the nuclear waste, and they built inside of it a 377-foot-wide concrete enclosure that holds more than 3.1 million cubic feet. So this is a pit that is the equivalent of 35 Olympic-sized swimming pools filled entirely with radioactive soil and debris that contained lethal doses of plutonium, all directly as a result of the U.S. activities here.
And it gets worse. This isn't just the nuclear trash from the Marshall Islands test. The U.S. took stuff from Nevada and put it on a boat and brought it there and buried it. Again, not in my backyard. They NIMBYed this. This structure today is in danger of collapsing. It is deteriorating over time, and the big concern is that it could soon reach even more of a crisis level due to the rising seas. It could, you know, this was a problem with Fukushima as well. When the ocean gets involved, nuclear weapons are an unstoppable force, but so is the ocean for now. And And shout out, as our anonymous teacher pointed out, shout out to the excellent work of the LA Times reporting on this situation, because there were, we'll look back at this in a second, but there's a solid case that the U.S. engaged in a series of cover-ups here. So a lot of the stuff that they were doing was classified at the time. And you could say, of course, it had to be because it was nuclear testing. But they also found, it was the LA Times who found that the U.S. had taken 130 tons of irradiated soil from a Nevada testing site and dumped it there into the dome. And they had also conducted biological weapons tests. So it wasn't just nuclear. They were like, hey, well, we've got this testing thing. Let's, you know, let's take the anthrax around the block for a spin. Let's just, we don't want to hurt anybody. Let's just see what happens.
Yeah, that's another thing that's generally a no-no, exploding eventually. It's not always, you know, against international law to do that kind of thing, but it's never a good look when you're seen testing biological weapons.
And the bill comes due. You know, nowadays it is, nowadays there are computer models that have the, that are sophisticated enough to predict some of the stuff that you could in the past only find out through actual physical testing. But still, there's not really an excuse for it because, again, people live there. And you can still see the dome today. Locals call it the tomb. It's been described as a nuclear coffin, burying the secrets of the U.S. as well. Officials in the Marshall Islands lobbied the U.S. government multiple times for help. American officials initially declined to help with this cleanup. They said, get this, well, the dome is on Marshallese land. And, you know, post-1979, you're a sovereign country. So therefore, it's the responsibility of your sovereign government. Hashtag not it.
That yeah. land is your land. That land's not my land. Just because we tested. Sorry.
That was perfect.
Wow, that sucks.
Yeah.
That song sucks. Leon, my God. No, it's true. That I mean, wow. Talk about like a little red hen type situation. You know, remember that fable where all the other, it's like a reverse little red hen, where all the other animals wanted to eat the bread that the little red hen spent all this time making. But at the end, she said, no, you can't have the bread because I made it. This is literally the other way around where it's like, you can't have the bread that we made that is going to kill you. Never mind. It's bad. It's a bad analogy.
No, I think it's good. I've got a bad one too, or at the very least it's crass. It's disturbingly similar to someone like two people hooking up and someone saying, hey, in addition to ruining my apartment when we hooked up, I think I am pregnant. And then the other person saying, you will be a fantastic single mother, and I wish you the best of luck with your apartment. And in this case, obviously, the child is nuclear waste. That's yes. what happened.
Oh, boy.
Are we going to get in trouble for that one? Do we need to cut that?
No, it's good. I think it's better than mine. It paints a disturbing picture, Ben. You're absolutely right. The child is nuclear waste, and yeah, it's like, we're not going to give you anything. We're not going to help you. In fact, they went even further. The folks that were left to clean up our mess weren't even helped in the most basic ways, which you'd think they would at least provide them some kind of protective equipment, you know, hazmat suits or what have you, rad suits if you're a Fallout fan. But no, not even that.
So there is an argument to be made where you could say, well, maybe this was just a matter of not knowing the full extent or the full potential danger of this kind of exposure. Because again, this is early in the days of nuclear testing. But how much water does that hold? How much nuclear waste fits in that rationalization dome? I would say not a ton, especially when we consider that the journalists at the Times dove deep into this. They interviewed every Marshallese U.S. official who had talked to them about this. They went through thousands and thousands and thousands of declassified documents, and they found that the U.S. did know some key pieces of information here, and they purposely withheld it from the government of the Marshall Islands So they didn't tell them about the weapon testing program. They didn't tell them about the stuff that was actually inside this dome. And the reason they didn't tell them, the reason they covered it up, is because they were pushing to sign a deal in 1986 that would release the U.S. government from any further liability regarding these tests. And this deal is important. It's still ongoing. But under this deal, they were supposed to pay settlements, right, pay fines, and also help the population of the country while also cleaning up and paying for that cleanup, right? So there's another study that was published by Columbia University scientists, and they found that levels of radiation in certain parts of the Marshall Islands, even today, rival the radiation levels found at Chernobyl and Fukushima.
I would also argue that the siloing and withholding of information rivals Chernobyl.
Yeah, information control. Sometimes it's a necessary thing, but it's always just so gross. And it's usually not necessary.
It's a really tough thing when we've got a story like this that is based on, you know, historical misdeeds or wrongdoing, like outright wrongdoing by some country. And then you can clearly trace the effects and the problems to present day and the future, where it's such a long lasting issue. It isn't very often that we hit on one of those topics. And this is certainly one. And I'm just so grateful to our listener who put us onto this. And my goodness, maybe we can find a way to help in some way. I don't know how, but I don't know what we do. We don't have the resources.
Well, yeah, we don't have much experience cleaning up nuclear waste, which I've always thought is a weak point of our podcast.
I would agree with you there, Ben.
Yeah, but we do know that there is an official holiday coming up, the Remembrance Day, on March 2nd every year, which honors the victims and the survivors of nuclear testing.
Yeah, let's throw a holiday at it. That'll be
right.
Fine.
That'll right. Do the job. Well, it raises visibility, at least. You can say
I agree.
That.
I agree.
You know, if you are a resident of the U.S. and you want to see further U.S. action in this area, you can always write to your local representatives. Your individual results may vary in that regard, unfortunately. But the facts are the same. Areas of the Marshall Islands have radiation levels that are almost double of what is safe for human habitation. Overall, as time passes, the islands are slowly becoming less radioactive, as long as that dome doesn't crack, right? But if you ask somebody, when will the Marshall Islands be free of radiation? When can people return to Bikini Atoll? The answer is really, I don't know. No one is sure. The capital city we mentioned is overcrowded due to rising sea levels and dozens of other things. It's becoming increasingly polluted. Their cleanup efforts that continue as we're recording the show today, and the Marshallese government continues to, rightly I would say, advocate for compensation. Why is this important now? Why are the events of more than half a century ago still relevant today? Well, aside from the radiation, that 1986 deal comes up for renegotiation in 2023. So there is a goal or milestone to push your representatives for if you think the U.S. should be doing more in regards to this. And again, look, we're just being honest here. We're not doing a hit piece on the United States. These are just facts. This was a real conspiracy.
Where do these territories fall in terms of, legislative representation?
It's a good question. So again, since 1979, the Republic of the Marshall Islands has been a sovereign country. However, due to the nature of the relationship between the U.S. and the Marshall Islands, if you're from the Marshall Islands, you can travel to the U.S. very easily, in theory, or legally, it's very easy. And the same if you are a U.S. citizen who decides to go to the Marshall Islands.
So it's kind of in a gray area then almost, right?
Well, it's part of it is the thing we mentioned at the top, the fact that it's what's called an associated state. So they have kind of a special unilateral deal.
So we can do what we will with them, but don't really give them any protection or representation?
Yeah, it's similar to, I mean, it's not the same thing as a territory. Like Puerto Rico right now is a territory, meaning that it does not have the representation in the government that a state would have, right? And the Marshall Islands doesn't have that either. They do have embassies and of course, a big U.S. military presence. But it's still kind of World War II era United States keeping that Pacific foothold, you know, for the next war.
And I'm sorry to harp on this, but I mean, so doesn't that make our actions almost like a form of like occupation? Like to go in there and tell people to leave and just do these tests? Like, what's the legal framework that makes that not a complete like act of war? Or, you know, I mean, maybe that's overstating the case a little bit, but I'm confused in terms of diplomacy, how we can justify what we did, even if it didn't cause all the problems that it caused.
Well, the art of diplomacy is the art of finding a way to justify anything you please, unfortunately. Yeah. It's a big business, but at the time these tests occurred, remember, the Marshall Islands were not yet a sovereign country.
That's right. Got it. The timeline, it gets a little fuzzy. There's a lot of moving parts in this one, but fascinating and heartbreaking story.
Yeah, and this is where we're at. So there's a tribunal that is established in 1988, 2 years after that 86 agreement, that is meant to keep an eye on the payments and the compensation the U.S. is supposed to offer. They concluded that the U.S. needs to pay $2.3 billion in claims. Congress and the U.S. courts have refused. And documents show the U.S. has paid a grand total of mission control. Can we get a drum roll? $4 million.
Woof.
But you guys, it's okay. It's all okay. None of that matters. Because in 2020, the United States government concluded that all this stuff, that leaking nuclear waste from the tomb, a.k.a. the dome, all that stuff is safe. You don't even have to worry about it anymore.
Oh.
Because... yeah, don't even worry about it.
Whew. Thanks, Uncle Sam. I feel great now.
You know what? Anyone out there listening, I hope one of you is like an associate producer at John Oliver's show. I need you to get John Oliver to do an episode on this, because if we do want to do something good for this, to raise some awareness or to start some surreptitious campaign to raise money without people realizing they're raising money for the Marshallese people, he could do it.
No one can shame the U.S. government into action like John Oliver.
Yeah. Yeah. Big fans here, John, if you're listening. And it always, I don't know, you guys, it always makes my day when over the time we've been doing this show where we end up doing an episode and then later the rest of the world decides that we're not crazy and it did matter. Like, it doesn't happen all the time, but it's a beautiful moment. Give us a beautiful moment, John, if you feel so inclined, and help the folks in the Marshall Islands out. You're right, Matt, that official report did conclude that the nuclear dome is not in danger of imminent collapse, but we have to remember island nations are fighting rising sea levels. And within our lifetimes, it is quite possible that we may see a country like the Maldives become entirely underwater and have to relocate the entire concept of its country to another safer landmass.
Well, and not to, you know, have two rose-colored glasses about it, but at least we are transitioning into an administration that acknowledges the science of climate change and rising sea levels and things like that, at least, maybe.
But still denies that the nuclear waste... No, I'm just joking. I don't know what the administration thinks about the dome.
Well, okay. Here's the thing, and this is going to make me sound very cynical and maybe a little bit too real politic. A change in administration or a change in domestic business can make an enormous difference. So if you hate, you know, we always say in the U.S., if you hate what's happening during one term, just wait 4 years, you know, and it'll change, often in a way that reverses other stuff. But we have to understand, outside of the bubble of the United States, the faces change, but a lot of the interventionist policies remain the same. It's not as if these international initiatives that have been in play for decades, and yes, including conflicts and wars and disputed territories, it's not as if they all of a sudden get a ping on their beeper. I don't know why I picture whomever is here having a beeper. They get a beeper ping and it says like, new president 333 or whatever. And they say, oh, okay, stop. We'll stop now. We'll stop making so much money.
And then the nuclear waste says, oh, we'll stop degrading right now. Right. We're done.
Right, right. But yeah, hopefully, the world can cooperate on this. One other thing that came out of this, by the way, is that the Marshall Islands are on the forefront of pushing for nuclear disarmament. They say, you know, we don't want anything like this to happen to anyone. And that's where we leave it today. We also have to ask you some questions, folks. What should the U.S. government do? What should the international community do in this regard? Is the U.S. really doing all it can? Are these good faith efforts now, decades later? If you have visited the Marshall Islands or if you live there now, we'd also love to hear your perspective. What is life like there? Are the effects of this still readily apparent in your neck of the global woods? Let us know. We try to be easy to find online.
You can find us on Twitter and Facebook, where we are Conspiracy Stuff. On Instagram, we are Conspiracy Stuff Show. If you want to check out one of the coolest Facebook groups, check out Here's Where It Gets Crazy. Or is it a page? Whatever it is. It's called Here's Where It Gets Crazy, and it's on Facebook, and you can find a lot of your conspiracy realists there, and you can have cool conversations with some of the best mods in the business running the show.
I think it's a group for sure.
Okay, it's a group.
You don't want to do that? You can give us a call. We've got a hotline, toll free, like the old days. Remember that? 1-833-STDWYTK. As Matt mentioned on our last episode, we have been getting a flurry of fabulous voicemails from you. Yes, you. So if you would, please limit it to 1 3-minute message. Let us know what to call you. Make sure you let us know if it's okay to use your voice, because we prefer to do that if possible. Or if you'd like to be anonymous, let us know that too. And you might hear yourself on one of our weekly listener mail episodes.
You can also leave us a review on your pod scraper of choice. It does make a difference. We are, as ever, grateful for your input. This show does not occur without you. You can pop over to youtube.com/conspiracystuff to see our weird, weird library of conspiracies that you may have thought of in the past, and ones that I can with certitude guarantee that you have not heard of. If you don't care for social media, if phones are not quite your thing, there is one other way you can always contact us, regardless of time, space, regardless of topic as well. Send us an email. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.